After a week that prompts for consolation, that old piece of wisdom from the Jewish tradition, this too shall pass, some questions about what we've been dealing with. Was it homegrown terrorism? Was it religious extremism? Was it an unstable personality? And while the event of Martin Place was still raw, came that shocking Taliban attack on a military-run school in Peshawar in Pakistan, leading to the deaths of more than 130 school children, all timely reminders of the global nature of terror. So joining me now is Anthony Bubalo. He's the research director for the Lowy Institute. He's also the director of the West Asia Program, which covers the Middle East, Central and Southwest Asia, where he served as a diplomat. Welcome back to Saturday Extra, Anthony.
Thanks.
I suppose we've just, in trying to bring a rational response to what we've been through, what's been topmost as you've reflected gradually as the days have gone by? And I might add, of course, we've got the utterly ghastly attack in Pakistan as well, just reminding us, I suppose, of the gulf between the two places.
Yeah. Look, there are two things that really stand out for me. One is the need to disentangle some of this stuff, because it's very easy to throw it all together under the rubric of terrorism. And certainly, there are elements of what we have seen this week in Sydney that do fall under that rubric. But there are different dimensions to this. One is obviously the problem we face in Iraq, where Iraq and Syria have now become a hub for 15,000 foreign fighters, according to the latest UN report. And the real concern is that these guys are going to get skilled up, they're going to get networked up, and then they're going to spread through the arteries of the international system over the next decade, really, and sow discord and violence using those skills and networks they picked up. But there is also the inspiration that Islamic State is clearly serving for homegrown, so-called lone wolf, for individuals that haven't gone to Iraq or Syria, may never go to Iraq or never contemplated going to Iraq or Syria, or maybe tried and couldn't get there, who just as a result of that inspiration pick up the materials they have to hand, undertake a terrorist attack. You know, obviously, when we're looking at what happened in Sydney, there are elements of an individual who's clearly mentally unbalanced, there's a background of criminality. That shouldn't automatically disqualify that from being labelled an act of terrorism, because, you know, many people who do commit acts of terrorism are unbalanced. Not all of them, but many are. Many do come from criminal backgrounds. And clearly, even if this particular individual, you have this strange incident where he's kind of suddenly converted from Shiism to Sunni Islam, but clearly Islamic State has served as an inspiration for him, or it's provided some imagery and some ideas that he's tried to appropriate. And even if this is serving some psychological problem, serving some desire for attention, serving some desire to kind of get beyond his criminal past, whatever it is, and we'll probably never know, there is that kind of very clear connection. And then what we see in Peshawar, where we see countries, Muslim countries, that are dealing with very, very serious domestic challenges, extremist-led insurgencies, and we've seen the awful consequences of that this week. That also harks us back to closer to home in Indonesia. And this is where a couple of these themes come together. In Indonesia, where over the last decade, the Indonesian government has successfully fought a campaign against terrorists, the concern now is that Indonesians are heading to Iraq and Syria and getting trained, and that they will inject their skills back into the terrorism threat we face in Indonesia. And that threat may again be reinvigorated by that injection of skill and networks.
Look, I appreciate your focus is primarily on the immediate analysis, but can we just step back and think, even what you've just said now, is there a struggle with modernity on here? Is that what is underway? And so that, in effect, this man, who was a notably unsuccessful man in so many areas of his life, reaches out for something called ISIS, which puts its hand up and sort of says, I wonder if it says actually to a heck of a lot of young men, this is your next route to forms of success or dignity or whatever it is. I just don't know quite what we do about that, because it does suggest to me deep-seated cultural issues here.
Yeah. Look, these particular cases, it's very difficult to do anything about it, because we can take all the steps that governments take to protect us from terrorism, you know, increase surveillance, track particular individuals, but ultimately you can't surveil the inside of someone's mind. And the truth is that when we're talking about the causes of terrorism, the reasons that push individuals like this towards committing these acts, it's almost impossible to know the cause, because you've always had in Islamic history a marginal group of individuals within Islam who have promoted an extreme and violent version of the religion. That marginal element has always been there and will always be there. The question is, why at various times in history do those ideas appeal to a broader range of the kind of population? There are periods when they don't, and there are periods when they do. And it's that question of why suddenly do other individuals latch onto those ideas? And there are a complex set of reasons. Some are going to be personal, psychological. Some of them are going to be kind of political. You see, for example, in the Middle East, I think the current wave of repression that we're seeing in the Middle East, in places like Egypt, is radicalizing future generations of extremists. So that's more societal and political. But in places like Australia, in cases like we saw this week, it's going to be much more personal, psychological. And, you know, you can deal with the big things in some ways. You can deal with the political and social conditions. You can track terrorists. You can toughen your laws. But as I said, you can't get inside the mind of some of these individuals.
No, and I mean, this is very tricky, but I often think about, and actually would love to do a whole program on whether Freud has ever come or even been sampled in the whole Islamic traditions. Mm. Because if you think about Freud, somebody suggested this to me and I've never forgotten it. Mm. Freud suggests you can remake yourself. You can defy your fate. You can find a way to talk yourself, as it were, into another state of being, hopefully a more healthy one. I just can't see in my studies of Islam that that exists easily, that there's a sort of almost a chance to change Providence's view of you.
Yeah.
Has that ever occurred to you?
Look, I know that there has been some work that's done on the kind of the psychological aspects of it and the social aspects of it. And some of that work is very prospective. You know, we tend to focus on the big kind of political, economic questions when a lot of this is about social connections. We know, for example, that, you know, some of the things that pull young men into these groups are not necessarily political
things.
But it's because their mates are doing it, because it's part of a social or family kind of network. So there is a place for the psychological side of it there too. I think where this leads us, though, is, you know, we can drive ourselves a little mad trying to design all sorts of measures to uncover why do people do this and how do we prevent it. And one of the things that came out of Sydney for me this week, and that was the other kind of strong thing, was the importance of social resilience. And it wasn't something the government did. So it was the kind of the extent to which people in Sydney have kind of come together, the whole thing around the I'll ride with you phenomenon. The fact that it's not from government, I think, is great. It shows that society can, as awful and as traumatic as these events are, we are strong enough to deal with them. Now, that's great from a remedial perspective, but that's also great from a preventative perspective, because the aim of terrorists is to terrorize. If society refuses to be terrorized, if society demonstrates that resilience, then the very lethality of terrorism is reduced.
Now, look, we actually did intend to invite you here to discuss football diplomacy before the events. You started looking into this 10 years ago, Anthony. You had very much long view in mind. And in a matter of weeks, Australia hosts the 2015 Asia Football Cup, the Asian Cup, here in Australia. Do you see this as soft power in action?
Absolutely. The question is, what can you do with this? What can you do with the fact that we're building a whole new level of engagement with Asia around sport, around something that's not transactional, that's something that's a bit more shared? How can you use that to both deepen their understanding of us, our understanding of them, and to kind of leverage it for other kind of, you know, mutual purposes?
Who's coming?
If you're looking at it from a diplomatic context, our three top trading partners in the region are coming, you know, Japan, Korea, and China. A number of Middle Eastern countries are coming as well.
Saudi Arabia,
Iran.
UAE.
Unfortunately, we're not seeing too many Southeast Asian countries, and it's unfortunate the Indonesians have perennial strugglers. My Indonesianist colleagues always tell me that within Indonesia, it's a great source of frustration that a country of so many million people can't get their act together on football. But that's also an opportunity, right, in terms of working with the Indonesians. We spend a lot of money in aid. If a little bit of that's diverted around
building a decent
football team, decent kind of training system, and using all the expertise we built up through the AIS and things like that, think how powerful that would be in terms of, you know, the messaging in Indonesia. So lots of our trading partners, lots of our important other kind of partner countries, lots of countries that have large communities here in Australia, So it's really an opportunity for us to kind of sell ourselves a bit in ways that are kind of unexpected. And we've seen a little bit of that with, you know, the Wanderers going to the Asian Cup Champions League final. That is already kind of seeing a kind of growing interest in Australia. And I'm saying that not just because I'm a Wanderers fan, but...
You sure? No, I mean, you just get their characters become real. Mm. We're in Group A, I'll let you go now, but we're in Group A with South Korea, Oman and Kuwait. Mm. So that's not an easy... Well, mind you, none of them are easy groups, really, when you look across.
None of them an easy group, but I mean, the real... I mean, if we can get through the group stage, the big matches for us are going to be... And it's turning into a really interesting and nice kind of sporting rivalry is with the Japanese. Who have a great team and are the big power at the moment. But that also demonstrates some of the potential on this, because we've never had a sporting relationship
never
with Japan
had fun,
before.
As it were.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk about Shinzo Abe next year, Anthony. I didn't have time to get to that so much. Look, thanks so much indeed, and I hope you have a very enjoyable Christmas, as I wish that to everyone.
You too.
Anthony Bublo, who's Research Director at the Lowy Institute for International Policy, is also Director of the West Asia Program. And the ABC, I might tell you, is the official free-to-air TV and radio broadcaster of the 2015 AFC Asian Cup. The competition kicks off on January the 9th, where the Socceroos take on Kuwait in Melbourne. So they'll all turn up, no doubt. You'll find details on our Saturday Extra website. So something to enjoy, which I think is great.